From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. What does the future of warfare look like? What constitutes a battlefield? Who are the players? How can a nation protect itself from an enemy it cannot see? Quantitative futurist Amy Webb discusses why the future of global security will be fought on virtual battlefields and how even the vocabulary of what is combat is in question.
When we're talking about individual acts of microaggression that occur in code or occur in our markets, we don't have a definition for that constellation of things as a singular act of war.
Plus, Webb explains why so many private companies are racing to outer space and what they're hoping to find. It's On the Record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. Impending scenarios of mass destruction, chaos, and global warfare usually evoke thoughts of nuclear bombs or chemical weapons. But quantitative futurist Amy Webb contends, quote, the future of our global security will depend on code, not combat, close quote. She makes that assertion in a recent newsletter of the Future Today Institute, which she founded. Webb is also professor of strategic foresight at New York University's Stern School of Business. We check in with her regularly to hear what's on her radar, which is at times sobering, but always fascinating. Welcome back to the show, Amy.
Good morning, Sheila.
You write that we could be at the end of the era of recognizable warfare. You contend the battlefield of the future is virtual, not physical. Unpack that.
You know, I think when we imagine war, we tend to think of guns and tanks and ships. And that is certainly plausible going forward. But I think, you know, we may be failing to recognize that wars are fought in other ways, too. It can be algorithmic in nature, which is a way of saying, you know, one country can infiltrate another country's power grids or stock markets and cause glitches, cause things to blip or to go offline. And individual instances of that aren't necessarily catastrophic. But if you wind up with completely unreliable systems, it becomes very difficult to manage your citizens, to do business and the like. And I think we're also starting to see instances of, you know, retaliation in the markets. So the trade war that the United States and China have been embroiled in have started to have real world repercussions. And 2 weeks ago, China, it looked like, devalued its currency, its yuan, in a way that could start to have negative effects on our country. And the problem here is that we don't really have any definitions or even any military units or Department of Defense units that are set up to deal with a situation in which we are being attacked. We're just not being attacked in the traditional ways. We're being attacked through code, or we're being attacked in these sort of weird economic ways that we haven't had to contend with before.
How does one even define an act of war in the context of what you're talking about?
The problem is that we don't have a definition for war when we're talking about individual acts of microaggression that occur in code or occur in our markets. We don't have a definition for that constellation of things as a singular act of war. And I think because we don't have, you know, definitions for war on those terms, it's going to be difficult for us to act in a way that gives us enough time to do something meaningful.
Well, some of it's difficult to even say it was a state actor as
That's
opposed
right.
to a company or a person acting on their own mm-hmm. behind this act of aggression.
And a government could simply say,
We didn't do that.
That's right. So, you know, these individual acts on their own may look like outliers, or they may not seem connected to anything else. But at some point, they're going to accumulate and, you know, connect in ways that hopefully we see as perhaps more significant than all of those individual acts on their own. But at the moment, we don't have a way to define that situation as an act of war or an act of aggression that would warrant some kind of response.
Well, it seems to me that the ransomware attack 3 months ago on the Baltimore City computers is an example of what you're talking about. So what are some other specific examples, either actual or potential?
Sure. You know, that Baltimore City example is a good one, and it's actually not an isolated incident. So there have been several cities, including the city of Atlanta, that have had to contend with hackers breaking in and holding various systems for ransom. Now, whether those are individual actors or part of another country's aggression toward the United States is something that is going to be difficult for us to suss out in advance. Usually, you know, people who work in cyber forensics, either as an attack is happening or more, you know, usually after the fact, are looking for certain hallmarks. These are, again, sort of difficult because we tend to look at each incident as new and novel. And what we fail to do is to connect the dots between all of them. I'll give you an example of this happening earlier, Sony. Sony is not the United States, but you know, it's a huge company. And for two decades, Sony kept suffering sort of seemingly one-off breaches.
Security breaches in its network?
That's right. And, you know, at some point, some people thought it was in retaliation for digital rights management. Over time, the organization treated each one of these as one-offs. And then a couple of years ago, there was a massive breach and a huge leak of emails and communications. And
I remember that. Yeah.
And it sort of escalated. The problem, and this has been pretty well documented, is that anybody could have seen that there was a bigger issue in the works. And that bigger issue was, you know, people were upset with the organization. They were railing against corporations. I'm saying corporations with air quotes. You know, there were some other forces at play. When we look at our own security in our country, in the United States, or even within our cities, we have to look at multiple areas of change at once. This isn't just about some, you know, guy who doesn't have friends sitting at home on his bed in his parents' house, who's bored and is, you know, messing around. These are very highly coordinated attacks now, and they're being done on behalf of other nation states or cells that are part of organized crime networks. We have to be much more sophisticated in our thinking going forward, I think.
That's quantitative futurist Amy Webb here on The Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about what war might look like in the future. Webb is also the author of The Big Nine, How the Tech Titans and Their Thinking Machines Could Warp Humanity, and of The Signals Are Talking, Why Today's Fringe is Tomorrow's Mainstream. Your newsletter lays out kinds of things that I would never think of weapons, like cars and... Well, I didn't even know until a few months ago what a CubeSat is. But yeah. It's kind of like a drone in some ways, right?
Kind of. I mean, so this newsletter that we put out usually weekly sort of tackles a single emerging technology or a trend that we're looking at. And then we use a device called Scenarios, which are data-driven stories that futurists use to talk through plausible outcomes. So they're not really science fiction. They're more about sort of if this happens, then what? What are the implications? So here's a plausible implication. There's a Chinese company called SenseTime, which is a market leader, I think, in computer vision. They do superior work. So the question that we're asking is, you know, what if... because there are so many automakers that are now rushing to try to get automation features in their vehicles. What if they partner with a company like SenseTime, which is domiciled in China, and as a result is sort of answering to the Chinese government? What if they partner with SenseTime because they've got superior technology, and that's what gets put into our cars to help our cars see around them so that we can have those automation features that are really cool that we really want. It's not that far-fetched to think that a third of Americans' cars that we drive around in could be harnessed and used as a gigantic spy network, right, by the Chinese government. And nobody
because
would ever know this.
That equipment would be somehow collecting data and funneling it back.
That's right. So, again, like, I'm not... We have data saying that this is a plausible outcome. I do not have any data, quantitative or otherwise, saying that this is happening. But the mere fact that it's plausible tells me that this is something we ought to be thinking about. And the challenge is that we don't tend to think about these seemingly one-off or these outliers, these strange risks that come in these places that we're not normally looking. We tend not to even give them any attention until after the fact, until something bad has happened.
So how does a government or a nation even begin to plan to protect itself from this kind of warfare?
You know, there are some incredibly smart people who are working within the Department of Defense, and they're working in various different units across the DoD. So I do have faith in our existing structure. That we've got great people and we've got a great military that is working very hard to protect our futures. That being said, I just don't think that I don't think that leadership in different areas of the government are prioritizing some of these other types of events. It took us a very long time to prioritize artificial intelligence here in the United States. You know, there are a couple of units within the military. There's more of a focus on artificial intelligence than there ever has been before. But it took us a while to get to that point. And part of the reason has to do with budget. You know, our current budget system, in the way that federal money gets allocated, it's really hard to sort of take an existing budget, add a bunch of things in, and then make the case for all of that in Congress, especially when you're asking for lots more money, and especially when you're asking for money for things that not everybody understands. People understand big things that go boom, right? But they don't understand, deep neural nets and, synthesized or synthetic information. I mean, these are sort of weird, wonky concepts. And in times when budgets are being stripped in a lot of places, it's hard to make the case. So I think we're going to need some leadership at the very top levels of our government and in our military to take a long, hard look at where some of these expenditures are today and to think hard about what we ought to be doing to prepare for the next, 5 to 20 years.
Well, I'll cop to being one of the people who doesn't really understand. Earlier, you were talking about the trade war. You seem to be implying that the metaphor that economics reporters use to talk about competition mm-hmm. is actually war mm-hmm. and should be thought of as war. I don't know whether you were making that case or not.
You know, I don't think it's competition on its own. I think it's a lot of the grand strategy that surrounds it. So I'll give you another use case. Last week, Huawei, which has been in the news quite a bit as a sort of target that our government has been looking at.
Chinese company.
Right. Telecommunications company. So it launched its operating system for mobile devices. It's called Harmony. It meant that Android is no longer part of Huawei's mobile ecosystem. Now, again, you might be thinking, I live in Baltimore. What does any of this have to do with me? I totally understand that sentiment, but here's why it matters. Huawei is an enormous company that sells cheap phones. So once they are all throughout Africa, all throughout Latin America, because their prices are much more competitive than ours, they've got a scale that we can't even wrap our heads around. And I think that starts to pose a national security threat for us. Again, I think we ought to be thinking through the implications of things.
How does social media fit into this? I mean, should I think of Twitter as something that can be weaponized?
Well, there are certainly a lot of people talking about Twitter and social media as a weapon. I think we have to be careful about using the word weapon, because I think it lends itself to hyperbole, and I'm not saying that we're not in a bad situation right now, but certainly the existence of systems that are automatically creating content and sending it out, automatically generating it, and even now brand new technologies that are very good at making photos and videos that look very lifelike or can replicate well-known people and put words in their mouth, right? These are called deep fakes, which some people may be familiar with. If we have distribution networks like Twitter that aren't exercising any editorial judgment but are merely processing the information that anybody wants to send around, you know, that potentially is a huge security problem going forward. It also confuses people. I mean, this is, you know, there's a lot of information that is inciting violence now that is being spread through social channels. And again, if that's originating from Russia, and there's plenty of evidence to say that it is, or if China is behind some of that, and the end result is that Americans are showing up in churches and at grocery stores, you know, and at schools, and they are using assault rifles to kill lots of people at a time, how can we not, again, like, how many... There are other things that led up to the mass shootings that we've been having, but at some point, isn't part of the problem, you know, potentially another nation that would like to cause disarray like this in the United States? And if so, then what? I mean, does that fall under, like, which part of our government is charged with dealing with that? I don't know that we have the answer to that right now.
A lot to think about. We have to take a break. We're talking with Amy Webb, the quantitative futurist and founder of the Future Today Institute. We've been talking about the future of warfare. After a quick break, we'll ask her thoughts about the race to outer space. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay tuned.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. Today we're talking with quantitative futurist Amy Webb. She's told us why she believes the future of global security will be fought upon virtual battlefields. Now we're turning our attention to outer space. Amy Webb, what are companies racing to discover in space, and who is doing it? Who's going?
So there is a space race on, and part of that is being driven by private companies, and some of it has to do with mining for resources. There are opportunities on asteroids, for example, to mine and gain access to resources that can be useful to us in various different ways on Earth. But there's a lot of this that's also being driven by space tourism. So, you know, for whatever reason, you know, for many, many years, the dream of leaving our planet and you know, living on a spaceship or living on Mars, I think, has been attractive to lots of people. And so we're starting to see a lot of companies inch their way closer to making that a reality. And in fact, I think in the next 2 years, we're supposed to see some of those first private space tourism flights launch.
So you smile when you talk about this.
Am I going to get on a space shuttle for outer space?
Well, that is a question I was planning to ask you.
Absolutely not. There's no way.
Because?
Why? You know, I spend a lot of time on airplanes as it is, and I just don't see myself making it on a very, very long flight off our planet. Here's what I'll say. I grew up watching Star Trek, original Star Trek, and I love all things space related. I think aside from being able to look out a window and observing the cosmos, which I think would be really cool, I don't see another purpose for me or for most people, really, to venture into space.
Well, that's why I noticed when you talked about it, you had a big smile. It sounded like, okay, this is like taking a vacation to, you know.
Very expensive vacation. It's like $250,000 is the going rate right now.
But if rich people want to pay for such an expensive vacation, does it have any implications for the rest of us? Is there?
I actually think it does. So this is going to sound like an obscure reference, but when I was a kid in middle school and in high school, I was on the debate team.
Of course you were.
Of course I was. Debate kids are cool. And the top, one of the ongoing topics had to do with space debris. And so we were talking, I don't want to divulge how old I am. I guess we're all friends. It's fine, right? So we're talking like in the 90s. And the issue of space debris has not gone away. It's actually gotten worse. Now, space is enormous, and we're talking about particulates, and it's not exactly like the garbage patch in the ocean. That being said, we are sending an extraordinary amount of things into space, whether they are the CubeSats that you referenced earlier. These are tiny handheld satellites that work together as a constellation to create, you know, live maps of what we're doing here on Earth. Everything from that to people sending their remains into space, people sending, trying to archive the world's information and putting it onto a disk and sending it into space. There's a lot of stuff we're sending up there, and not everything is reaching space successfully. There have been a lot of explosions. And so, you know, the more things we send up, the more we have to think about how much we're contributing to the space debris that's up there now and whether that's going to, again, cause us problems down the road. Because it's not just in the United States. Israel sent up a payload that had a bunch of stuff on it, and it was unsuccessful. So, you know, it's just something to think about.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with futurist and author Amy Webb about the realities of the race to outer space. Who or what entity is taking the lead in the race to outer space?
Yeah, so the answer to that question depends on what we're asking. So if we're talking about who's the public face in the private sector, I would say Elon Musk. You know, who's doing really interesting research? Blue Origin, which is owned by Jeff Bezos, who owns Amazon. And I could rattle off 36 more companies based in India and China and the United States, you know, and France and Japan. There's quite a bit of work being done. I guess I didn't even mention Virgin Galactic. So that's Richard Branson's company. So whether we're talking about companies trying to land on or simply brush by asteroids or get to the moon or get to Mars or simply to be high enough in orbit that you get to sort of see both space and Earth at the same time, you know, there's a lot of activity.
You always sketch out best case and worst case scenarios in your newsletters. So what's the best and worst case scenario with regard to the space race?
You know, as always, the best case scenario, I think, is collaboration. So and I guess that answers the question about the worst case scenario. You know, we tend to compete. And we don't often think about the next order implications of all of that private sector competition. So I just wonder what happens as we're all racing to get to space. We haven't really defined space as a public good, you know, and we haven't really thought through what sort of planetary global norms and standards should look like. I mean, we have some because we have the European Space Agency and we have NASA. But in terms of all of this commercial activity, again, if we model out, you know, 20 years from now, what are we going to regret that we've done? I think that it would be useful for us to be thinking through that right now. The thing that people talk about a lot is setting up some kind of civilization on Mars. And I know that that is fun to think about. But I have to ask, what is it that we humans are going to do on Mars that's any different from what we are doing here on Earth? You think we leave the planet and suddenly we're all going to get along and conserve our resources and, you know, the tragedy of the commons isn't going to take over? I think we're going to wind up launching our earthly problems into space. And now we've just got a rougher situation because, you know, we're on another planet.
On that note, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Amy Webb is founder of the Future Today Institute. You can sign up for a free newsletter that discusses the topics we've covered today and many others that are forward-looking. We have a link to how to do that at the On the Record page at WYPR.org. I'm Sheila Cass. Glad you're with us on the record. Join us again tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.